Good day, and welcome to episode 2 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. This week's topic, Women in Crisis. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph, Ontario, and beyond. Since the onset of the pandemic, we've been meeting virtually. For the past few weeks, our conversations have demonstrated how some of the most vulnerable members of our community are experiencing the COVID lockdown. On June 11th, 2020, Sly Castaldi spoke to us about the recent struggles facing vulnerable women in Guelph and Wellington County. Sly is the executive director of Guelph-Wellington Women in Crisis, which has supported women experiencing sexual violence and domestic violence since 1977. She's been a part of the anti-violence movement for 30 years and has advocated for women experiencing violence both locally and at the provincial level. Here's Sly speaking to our moderator, Hina Mistry, and a little later, you'll hear the voice of Dustin Brown, who that day was monitoring our very active Zoom chat room.
I just want to start by thanking Sly for also joining us today. Sly Castaldi, she's the director, the executive director of Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis. She's been in the anti-violence movement for 30 years. She chaired the Guelph Wellington Action Committee on Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence, and she's the chair of the Guelph Wellington Legal Clinic as well. She was also appointed as co-chair of the Premier's Roundtable on Violence Against Women for 2015 to 2018. She sits on the board of the Ontario Coalition of Rape Crisis Centres and the board of the Ontario Association of Interval and Transition Houses. So it's really great to have you here today. Sly, thanks so much for joining us. So I just want to acknowledge that Guelph is situated on the territories of the Mississaugas of the Credit and the Anishinaabe peoples. I think that it's important to do like land acknowledgements as well because it helps us sort of reflect on, why we got here, how the different processes that have sort of taken place on the land that we're situated on, as well as, our relationship to the people who are original holders of this land, as well as our responsibility to them as well. And many of whom are still here as well on and living here today. With that though, I'd like to turn it over to Sly.
Sure, thanks. Hi everyone. As you can imagine, the last three, has it been 3 months? I've lost track of time, but the last 3 months have been a bit of a challenge for my organization in terms of what COVID has done to us. I want everybody to know we have been fully operational since COVID happened. I mean, some people got confused around the shelter stuff, but because I think sometimes people confuse our shelter with the homeless shelter. And there was a plan for the folks who were getting services from the drop-in center and Wyndham House to all go into a hotel, whereas we implemented the measures that public health was putting out, sometimes daily, sometimes hourly, right away with the residents and the staff at the shelter. So we were able to maintain keeping the women in the shelter housed and safe there for the entire time during this pandemic, which was no easy feat. I mean, I think the fact that we started to put in more restrictive guidelines in the shelter just because, as you all know, public health was changing guidelines, sometimes daily, but sometimes hourly. So trying to keep ahead of everything that was happening was a bit of a challenge. But we had to introduce some pretty restrictive measures at the shelter as the days went on. And so basically, women in the shelter were, in the beginning, everybody had to self-isolate into their rooms. So what we did as an organization is right away, we purchased a whole bunch of TVs to put in everybody's rooms. We purchased a whole bunch of computers to keep the kids, being able to do their schoolwork, because we knew that the schoolwork, the school year was going to be shot. And through Danby, we were able to get a good deal on little mini bar fridges. So we purchased a whole bunch of them to put them in the rooms, because we had to close our kitchen in terms of when the women come to gather to eat, the women and kids, but that was no longer allowed because of social distancing. And we had to get through the 14 days of isolation in the beginning. And so we wanted to ensure that mom and kids had, you know, yogurt and snacks in their fridges so they could do breakfast fairly easily. And then lunch and dinner were served to their rooms every day since the beginning of mid-March. So it's been, so we had to change even the way we actually feed everybody in the shelter. And all of a sudden we had to buy stuff that, you know, requires almost like takeout, which was hard to get used to and hard for our chef to get used to in terms of how you make meals that are easy to deliver to rooms. And, you know, we have, and so that was a big deal, but it, hats off to, yes, I saw that in the chat. Jim was really great. And because he did it for us, I put him in touch. I put all my colleagues across the province in touch with him too. The other shelter directors were all buying mini bar fridges and stuff for the rooms, just to try and keep, to try to make it easier to keep women and kids entertained in their rooms, safe in their rooms, and having the things that they need in their rooms, because it's quite challenging. For those who have never been in our shelter, they were never designed for a pandemic, right? So people need to understand that. They were designed for communal living and support, right? So there's a ton of shared spaces. So we even had to, like right away, we had to cut down the number of women that we serve. So we are funded for 28 beds. We're often at 30, 31 because we put in cots and extra stuff, and we don't count cribs as a bed, so we just put them in the room, but so that we can keep the other room available for people. So those are all shared rooms, and according to public health, we weren't allowed to share rooms anymore, so we had to cut down to, I think, 16 rooms. So we had to cut down to almost half of the people that were able to serve, which was it's a really big deal for us. But we remained functional through that whole time, and we just kept adapting to the new rules. I have to say, in the beginning, it was a nightmare trying to find PPEs. So in order to keep all of our staff safe, just getting masks and gloves, as you can imagine, everybody in the province, especially our healthcare workers, were trying to get them nonstop. And so we fell further down the priority list on trying to access PPEs. So through our very generous volunteers and supporters, we had a bunch of people making us homemade masks, and they kept supplying them so that we could access that until we could actually get other PPEs. But even stuff like hand sanitizer, wipes, the disinfectant spray and all that kind of stuff, that stuff started to disappear off all of our distributors' shelves. And so that was a real challenge for us, and trying to, you know, keep everybody safe. And we didn't, you know, the province did a pretty good job of trying to support all congregate living organizations. And I am grateful for the support. Although nobody had the PPE distribution and availability figured out. And so even the hospitals and the healthcare workers were somewhat caught short, and especially the long-term care centers. So, you know, there are a lot of lessons to be learned in this pandemic that I hope will go further in terms of having organizations, all organizations, including healthcare, long-term care, congregate living settings, more prepared around what we need. And even what we need was changing every day. Like at first, they were saying, you know, do not use medical masks, surgical masks, because we have to save them all for the healthcare workers. Well, some people can't breathe with the homemade masks. Some people have issues with the homemade masks. They're not as comfortable. They're not as bulky. So even trying to get them so that staff and clients had options became even a bit more challenging. But I do want to give a shout out to all of the organizations in town who provide shelter services, both homeless, violence against women, addictions, mental health, because we all came together early on to create the support model, because we were more privileged than the homeless sector, because we could cut our rooms down to half of our clients and maintain social distancing. But the drop-in center wasn't able to do that. Neither was the Wyndham House with their youth homeless shelter. So they all came together. We created a plan to put folks into a hotel and move the staff there. So they had their own private bedroom, rooms, bathrooms, and TVs and all that kind of stuff, which made getting through COVID a little bit more manageable. And then together, there was the plan around the isolation center, so that anyone in a shelter who tested positive or was showing symptoms would be going to the assessment center. And Red Car, God love them, they stepped up to the plate and said, we will be providing the transportation for all shelter people. So they, our clients who were going to the assessment center, were masked up. Red Car came and picked them up, brought them to the assessment center. From the assessment center, they went to the isolation center, and the good folks there would take care of them for the next 14 days. So that part worked out really, really well. And Ignatius was fabulous in stepping up to do that plan, because they had both the rooms and the availability of providing food for the clients there. So that worked out really well, and public health was part of that, and all of the community health center, all the shelter directors, addictions and mental health. So everybody came together. So I know you guys already know that this community works incredibly well together, especially in times of crisis. We have an ability to just, you know, swoop in, do what needs to be done, and get it done. So as a community, we had a pretty good plan for our vulnerable populations. Not the perfect plan, a decent plan. And so it's important for people to understand that. I will say this, and I will say this to our leaders and anyone who will listen. Shelters, makeshift shelters, whatever, are not the place to pass a pandemic through. Okay, these are ways that we cope, these are ways that we survive, but we need affordable housing. If anything demonstrated through this process that was really hard, we were struggling ourselves to stay in our house, to figure out how to bring some structure to our lives, to keep engaged, to, you know, to be separated. Being in a shelter during this time is brutal. Brutal, no matter how comfortable you try to make it, no matter how supportive you try to make it. Housing is a human right issue, and that's what we need to focus on as a community. Supportive housing, affordable housing, because even though we managed to manage through the crisis, it wasn't ideal, and it's certainly not the same experience that our clients are used to having. The women and the kids at the shelter have lost that sense of community, the coming together, the eating together, the supporting each other. The whole point of being in a Violence Against Women's Shelter is that you get that kind of support. We've had to isolate everybody to maintain the public health guidelines. It's not the place to be during a pandemic, right? They were physically safe, but I would say to you, emotionally, it was even harder on them because they watch the staff come and go, right? They do their shift and then they go back to their lives. And, you know, whereas they were stuck in that shelter and they could not leave because we can't, because every time you leave, you would have to isolate, right? So it was a constant revolving door around isolation to keep everybody safe. So, I mean, for us, that was really challenging for us in providing the services, but also our services don't look the same by any stretch of the imagination, right? We're providing shelter and food and safety, but everything else has to be, you know, guidelines. And then all of our counseling services, which we, through our counseling programs, like, so we service anywhere between 1,300 to 1,500 women a year through all of our programs. So the shelter only has 30 beds. And because there's no housing in the city, you know, women are staying longer and longer. So we've got women who are there 6 months, 8 months, getting close to a year because there's nowhere for them to go. And so we can't even service. Like, there was a time where we would see maybe 300-400 women and kids go through our doors in a year. Now it's more down to 100 women because once you get in, there's nowhere else to go. Right? So those are huge issues. So our counseling programs, our transition program, family court support, the transition program, our rural women's support program, the sexual assault center, human trafficking, all of our outreach programs went remote. As soon as the Prime Minister said everybody should be at home. So we had to spend a lot of money getting laptops and Chromebooks and getting everybody sort of upgraded in there to be able to work from home because, you know, our client data system is on web-based, all this kind of stuff that we had to do to get people ready to, you know, do their counseling from their house. And even that is different, right? We had to suspend groups were suspended right away. So there was no opportunity for women to come together and share their experiences of either sexual violence or domestic violence. So that had to go, and we moved remotely to individual counseling. And it's not the same, right? There's nothing like when you're with your counselor, being able to process whatever experiences that you have had when someone is sitting there face-to-face with you. And now we're doing everything on the phone or Zoom. And I don't know about you guys, but I am Zoomed out. I've got Zoom fatigue beyond belief because it's even harder to maintain this kind of, like, you know, you got to make sure that you're staring at people, that you, first of all, even people learning Zoom took a week, you know, between their microphones and their videos to figure out how to actually work the thing. And then once they got everything working, and then it's like, okay, now, you know, after two or three Zoom meetings or four Zoom meetings a day, you can't even function. So if you've got four or five or six clients a day that you have to connect with, it's exhausting, right? And while it has helped with our rural and remote clients and our rural women's support program, women who had a harder time because of transportation, lack of transportation in the county, they found this more useful because then they didn't have to worry about getting to their counselor appointments, but it's still not the same, right? So, but we've been able to do that. And because so much of what we do is give women a lot of practical support through our outreach programs, so we give them food baskets, because I don't know if you guys know, but the seed program is in my warehouse at Elizabeth Street. So if they have anything extra, they put together a little basket for a mom and kids who are desperate for food or can't make it from week to week to food. And then we give out a ton of gift cards to clients every week. So, but getting that to women when everybody's working remotely became a challenge, right? So, you know, we had to figure out, okay, where does the drop off? How do you do it safely? You know, you can't touch anything. Everybody's got to be masked up and gloved up and all this kind of stuff. Everything became harder in terms of delivering the services. So hats off to the staff who work at WIC. They did an incredible job in terms of keeping going, keeping the services going, keeping the support going. But we have seen an uptake in women who want to connect with counselors because they're struggling. They're struggling with mental health, they're struggling with the isolation, they might be trapped with their abusers. And it's really hard when women reach out, because unless we know when it's safe to call them back, if they're living with their abuser, you know, if we don't get that window of when they're available to call back, then we miss them and we have to wait for them to call us back. And so even that became more of a challenge. It could take 2 weeks before we were able to find the time so she could connect with us. And the ones who were at high risk, you know, if a counselor was able to connect with her and talk with her, but if the phone goes dead, you have no idea what happened. Or if she, you know, leaves the call all of a sudden, you have no idea what happened. You just have to wait for her to reach out again, right? So that was a very stressful for the staff to have to deal with and wait with while they're at home by themselves, and they don't even have the rest of their colleagues around to, you know, immediately go in and debrief and talk and say, hey, I had a really tough call. The suicidal calls are increasing. So it's become, and I don't believe that we have even started to see the long-term impacts of COVID on mental health, right? Because we're still in the middle of it. We're still coping. You know, and then you have people, and then you have people who don't believe it, who don't believe what's going on, who think that this is all, you know, whether it's a conspiracy or the government's just trying to control the public, and they're using these kind of measures. But some people believe it, and so they're saying, why can't I come and see you? Right, and so it's like, you know, so our office is, our Elizabeth Street office and our rural offices are still closed to the public. I need people to understand that, right? Staff have been going to the office every day still, because we still have to function. We still have an organization to run. We still have all of those things to do. But the first couple of weeks, it was just one person in the office to make sure, because we were ordering stuff, get deliveries, answer, make sure the phones were being responded to, et cetera, et cetera. And then we moved to two people in the office a day, and then three people in the office a day. Now we're up to five people in the office a day. But until the province kind of lifts those measures, they don't feel comfortable being able to sort of say, okay, now the public can come in, because I don't have the plexiglass in yet. You know, I've ordered it because that's now the new toilet paper. So trying to find that and then get it installed, trying to go touchless. Now, I don't know about you guys, but now you can't find touchless stuff anywhere. Touchless paper towel dispensaries, touchless hand sanitizer. So that's become now the Hunger Games hunt, right? So everybody's looking for those kind of things. And because I think it's also the future. We're going to move less and less to touching things and more to all touchless stuff. So we might as well make the investment up front. But until we have all of our safety procedures and precautions and preventative measures in place, we can't open up to the public yet, even though the premier had announced that face-to-face counseling could resume. Meanwhile, how? And they didn't even give us the heads up on that. But you know, and it set clients up who said, well, the premier said it could happen. Well, it can't happen in a vacuum, right? And so you know, some things I've appreciated, some things the support has been good. Other things have been really chaotic, lack of communication, changing directions and minds. And it's hard. It's hard when you're trying to keep everybody safe, but there's no clear communication around what the actual guidelines are or the rules, especially when they keep changing, right? So, but long and short of it is, we've maintained operations all along, albeit it doesn't look the same. I'm not sure when it's ever going to look the same, but we've been able to function and maintain service, which is the critical part. But as I said, shelters are supposed to be a short-term solution. They're supposed to be an emergency solution for a week or two till we could get things figured out. They are not supposed to be where people live, right? And if we don't figure out this housing situation in this community or in this province or in this country, anytime we have another disaster or a world crisis or an issue, the pressure is going to blow, because what pandemics do is they show all the cracks in the system. And I can tell you, they're all cracked.
Thanks so much, Sly. It was so informative hearing that. And it must be really also like difficult for your staff as well to like also be, you know, dealing with this and like seeing this sort of, you know, firsthand. I would imagine like support for them also must be something that also, you know, is something that you're thinking about as well. So the first question that we had was from Morgan. She asked, where can we donate to help make up some of what was lost because Hope in the City couldn't happen this year?
I could pitch for, our organization. I think that because what I'm worried about in particular for this year is that I'm hopeful that the United Way makes up their goal this year. They help a ton of organizations. So I feel like what I should say to people is donate to the United Way for their campaign this year, or direct it specifically to their campaign, because I think there's going to be a lot of organizations hurting this year. All of our ability to fundraise has been screwed. Yeah, you guys know that we had to cancel our biggest fundraiser of the year in April. And I tell you, I held off in March making that decision as long as I could, because I was hopeful that somehow things were going to turn around, or I was hopeful that there was going to be, I don't know what I was praying, right? And then when it became so obvious that we would never be allowed to gather in such crowds and we had to cancel, it was heartbreaking, because that fundraiser for us raises $100,000. It's our biggest fundraiser of the year. So it's gone, right? But I don't feel comfortable saying, hey, donate to this organization or donate to that organization. I feel more comfortable saying, if people are interested in donating, donate to this year's campaign, because United Way supports, what is it, 80 or more? I should know this, I'm on their campaign team, but I can't remember, but I'm worried about all of the organizations who are not going to be able to fundraise very much this year.
Yeah, and it makes sense as well, like that you'd say that too, because of how like how Women in Crisis is so interlinked with like other support systems in the community. Mm-hmm. The second question that we had from Morgan was, other than money, what other resources can we help with during the changes needed for COVID-19?
Right now, I would say, again, the SEED program is feeding a lot of marginalized people in this community. Donate to them because you know, they're in my building. So I see the truck come in, I see the food go out, and feeding people is critical. If you want to really help, start pressuring our politicians around housing. No one should be in a shelter or shelter-like or makeshift shelter during a pandemic. It's brutal. It's not fun, you know? And I think that there are ways, there are lessons that we're all learning. And I think I was talking to the Toronto Star, I think, I can't remember, because of course everybody was into the crisis within the crisis, the pandemic of violence. Pandemics just show what's always going on in a big way, right? So nothing's new, you know, and you know, everybody clued in that when public health said, stay home, that didn't work for abused women and kids. It didn't work for kids who are being abused by their parents. It didn't work for people who are struggling with addictions. It doesn't work for people who are struggling with mental health. I know it's the one size fits all solution, but those groups in particular, that solution was the worst thing you could do, right? So this is where you have public health and what we know about issues really coming to a head, right? In a pandemic, when a virus threatens us all of us, we're all susceptible to it, all of a sudden, the priority that our governments take seems really helpful. Oh, there's money for this, there's money for to give you an income, because guess what, you lost your job. There's money to support organizations, there's money for this, there's money for that. The priorities shifted on a dime because it impacted all of us. If only we could think about the issues that the communities are struggling with the same way, because those issues impact us all as well, whether we're paying for it through our social safety networks or whether we're paying a whole bunch of other ways, those issues affect us all. And so we saw what was possible. We saw basic income is actually possible, right? So if you want to help, keep the pressure up, right? But also donate to organizations that especially those who are feeding or providing practical support to people who need it. That would be my. It feels weird. I'm not gonna advocate for us in terms of that kind of way, because it feels too weird for me. But I also believe in the collective good of the United Way. So I think that. And if anybody can sew or make masks, find smaller organizations. Find the smaller ones who don't have people who are making masks for them. I've got plenty now because I've had a team of seamstresses and sewers who've been sewing nonstop. And so we're in good shape that way, but I know other organizations might not have it. And especially now as people start to reopen their services, they won't have had any of this stuff. I've been on the hunt for all of the PPEs for 3 months. I'm better off now, and help people get hand sanitizer because everybody's going to need it and it's hard to find.
Thank you. I really like how you're also reminding us all to just, you know, that it's, yes, we're focusing the discussion on women in crisis, but you, again, like, you can't separate these issues from one another, like homelessness, the mental health discussion, you know, opioid crisis that we talked about last week too, like they're all so closely locked together. The next question was the one that I had posed. So you kind of spoke to this already, but my question was, how has support for victims of sexual violence and domestic abuse changed since the onslaught of COVID lockdown in March? And how are women who the shelter cannot help being supported, and what are the gaps?
As I said, in terms of the sexual assault centers across the province, I can tell you everybody's doing their work remotely because everybody was, you know, sent home to do it. So, and so that's the service that is across the province. Remote counseling, that's how sexual assault centers, rape crisis centers are doing it. I think that for us, we have struggled with, in terms of the shelter service, as I said, has struggled. And there, so we are using, I'm not telling you which one, but we are using a hotel for women who are deemed safe enough to be in a hotel, because that's what you also have to figure out, is she safe enough to be in a hotel, or B, she can't function any longer in the rules of the shelter. You got to remember, we have women and kids in the shelter, right? So, and the needs of one cannot outweigh the needs of many in terms of how we provide support. So if someone is struggling with complex mental health, complex addiction, and can't manage the guidelines, we can't keep them there. It's not fair to the kids who are exposed or to the other clients. And so we are using a hotel to try and offset support that way, right? It's not easy. It's not easy. Congregate living is not easy. It's not easy if there are complex issues with people in the shelter, right? I said, you know, I would never build a shelter like we have ever again in my life. If ever I get funding to build one in the county, which is something I'm working towards, just because even trying to get the make more space in the Guelph shelter for Guelph residents and keep county residents in a shelter. But I would build it apartment style so women have freedom, privacy, able to manage their own affairs, and then provide support there and groups and whatever. But they have their own living space and that they can manage their own stuff, right? But unfortunately, we don't have that shelter. We have a very communal shelter, and it's been tough there. You know, we have issues with drugs in there. We have issues that everybody's struggling. And we have had to, our harm reduction is a very tricky thing. You know, we work from a harm reduction model. It's hard to find that balance between, okay, this is what harm reduction looks like pre-COVID, and this is what harm reduction looks like in COVID, and how do, and post-COVID, like, you know, we don't allow drinking and consumption of drugs in our shelter. You know, you can use, but not in the shelter just because of the kids. Well, that had to change, because if we can't do that, women will bolt to seek those things out. And so we're buying stuff that we've never bought before in our lives to try and maintain and keep women in the shelter from going out and seeking unsafe things. That's hard. Like, this is not how we normally provide service, but we're between a rock and a hard place trying to do stuff so that women don't leave to seek things in an unhealthy or dangerous way. But when we, if we ever, like, it's hard to imagine the world now post-COVID, but if we ever go to that, how do you figure out, okay, what did we learn from this? What can we keep doing? And what do we have to pull back? Right? It's a process. And that's the thing for us, the learning is a process. It's not a destination, because there's no perfection in this.
So in light of the recent conversations about the relationship between police in Canada and communities of color and other vulnerable communities, is Women in Crisis considering looking into the relationship between women of color in crisis or other minority women and Guelph Police Services?
To be honest, I have not, it's not my priority right now to work, to look at Guelph Police Service right now. My priority is looking internally with our own BIPOC staff and volunteers and figure out what it is we want to do going forward, and get some direction and some feedback from them first before checking in with Guelph Police Services. I mean, look, COVID and then the last 2 weeks on top of COVID, I don't know about you guys, but what happened to George Floyd almost did me in terms of, you know, just trying to keep going and coping and trying to manage. And then that happening was just about almost too much in terms of stuff. And as a as a white woman, I had to do my own processing. I had to do my own thing. And then as a white leader of an organization in this community, I had to do a lot of processing and figuring out what I want to do, what I want to do in terms of this organization, what do I want to do in terms of our community, and then what I want to do personally. And so I landed on working internally first with my with our own people, our own staff, our own volunteers, and then thinking about outward and our relationship.
So what is the relationship between Guelph-based sexual violence support networks and Guelph Police Services? How much of a role do police play in protecting victims of sexual violence and domestic abuse? Or like how much intervention do they have in your services that you offer?
Well, as you guys know, most people don't call the police, right? So sexual violence, you have less than 6% of women in this country reporting. And I think the number is even lower now. So in terms of sexual violence, that's not the go-to. The go-to is community organizations. And if you know anything about the dynamics of how sexual violence works, if it's historical sexual violence, chances are you might be already connected to a community organization that has believed you, that is providing support to you in the way that works for you. The thing about the way we work as a feminist organization is you do not have to fit our service, right? We fit you. So if you come to our sexual assault center and you said, I was abused as a child, but it's just triggering me because I have a daughter now the same age, and now I'd like to start talking about it, that's where you start. There's no, this is the program and this is what you go through and this is, we just work where you're at, right? And so much damage has been done to survivors of sexual violence by a lot of institutions. And so sometimes our work is just repairing that damage, recreating trust, having people being believed, right? And so I would say that a majority of people, if it's less than 6%, the police are not the go-to around sexual violence. They only go to the police if they want to move forward with charges. And even then, it's hard because A, you have to be believed. B, there has to be enough evidence to proceed. And so sometimes it's even a bit of a setup. For some women, just being able to tell an authority figure your story is enough. For others, they want justice. But there's no guarantee of that justice at the end because sexual violence has one of the lowest conviction rates of any crime. You've got no stake in the outcome because it will destroy you through the process, right? So there's that. In terms of domestic violence, I don't know, the latest stat was about 24%, 27% of women actually go to the police. So the police become involved in domestic violence in different ways. Neighbors might call, right? And then they're in the middle of it. Or somebody reports to Family and Children's Services and there's an automatic, there's an automatic reporting. If police go to your house and you have kids, you're automatically reported to Children's Aid because you have kids in the house around domestic violence. So the state becomes involved in domestic violence in a whole bunch of different ways. Do many women call the police? I think they call the police when they're desperate around their own safety and there's no other choice, right? Because what I'm going to tell you guys this, when there is a relationship between a victim and the perpetrator, the accused, whether it's sexual violence or domestic violence, the criminal justice system doesn't deal with this issue well. It deals with the issue when they're strangers. If you beat me up on the street, then everybody gets it. If you're my boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, partner, wife, and you hurt me, the emotional connection there makes it very difficult to go to the authorities. If you're my boyfriend, date, acquaintance, whatever, and you rape me, it makes it really hard to go to the police because there's a connection there. And in my experience of 30 years, the criminal justice system has never been the place that effectively deals with women in crisis. I'm not saying anything other than that's my experience of the situation. You know, it's okay. It works for some people if it's strangers. But when there's a connection, there's a relationship, it gets all muddy and cloudy, right? And women to this day, they don't want their partners to be in trouble. They want the violence to stop, and people don't get that, right? So, and it's hard. And if you are from a marginalized community and this is happening to you, it gets even worse for people. Mm-hmm. Right? So, I mean, let's not pretend that justice is blind or that, you know, we can't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? The events of the past couple of weeks have made it blatantly obvious that, you know, the criminal justice system criminalizes marginalized communities, and that's a fact.
Your rage was really informative, and it really brought to light, like, again, like all the different gaps and limitations of the kinds of systems that we have today that this pandemic is showing the cracks of. Okay, I'm actually going to turn it over to Dustin to see if he wanted to pick a question that maybe came up in the chat that we can ask you now, if that's okay.
Sure, yeah, I'll have a look there. I do know, Sly, somebody wanted to know whether you would support if in the event the police kills a citizen, would you support there being a mandatory coroner's inquest rather than?
Oh, of course. Without a doubt.
Okay.
You know, yeah. I think if I were Chief Colby right now, I would be meeting with community leaders to sort of say, what are we going to do? How do we push this forward? You know what really struck me? I saw this thing. I don't know where I saw it, because sometimes I have to do the, I have to step away from, because I am tired from the pace of the last 12 weeks. But somebody said to me that, somebody had posted or something about the, they saw, you know, with the protests, that especially in the States, this isn't so much about, because I don't think our, but in the States, the cops are outfitted like RoboCops from the future. Every bit of equipment they have is like state of the art, but they see doctors and nurses and PSWs and long-term workers with garbage bags on as their equipment. And that kind of like struck a real deep chord with me around where we invest and how we invest that kind of stuff. And it's important to remember that kind of stuff. You know, healthcare workers, PSWs, people working in long-term care need to have the proper equipment that they need to do their jobs. End of story. You know, health in this country is a right. And so is those who are, and so those who are providing it need the equipment that they need. And so it's interesting because it does show us priorities. It does show us where we invest. And the other thing I wanted to say really quickly was I saw this post that on the weekend, because I went to the protest, and I can tell you that, you know, I had my mask on, but there was no social distancing at that, because the crowds were so massive, right? So I marched at the very, very back because it was the only place I could feel that there was room to keep myself safe, right, and others safe. So somebody posted something that it inspired me, and it was important, but they said, some people are going to protest, some people are going to do social media, some people are going to self-educate, some people are going to donate money, some people are going to work within, some people are going to work on the outside, some people are going to have hard conversations with their family and friends and, you know, whatever. And it was sort of like, doesn't matter what you do, but just keep your foot on the gas. Because a revolution takes many lanes, right? There is no one way to do this. And we need to support all those ways because they all kind of matter, right? So I thought that I'd leave you on that note. Is that okay? I'm going to run now, guys. Thank you very much for the opportunity to chat. And yeah, nice seeing you.
Thank you.
Okay, ciao.
Thanks for your time, Sly. See you.
Bye-bye.
As you just heard, Sly had to leave the meeting, but there was a desire from attendees to keep the conversation going with a number of moving personal stories being shared and views expressed. We have just time to include a couple of those here. You'll hear the voices of Susan Watson and Kate Nixon, both strong community advocates.
I guess I'll jump in here. I definitely thought that one thing that didn't get talked about in the conversation was, and Dana brought it up, just like the importance of, you know, like addressing men in the conversation as well. And you know, that like, yes, empowering women, like Susan brought up that Wendo training, like for anyone who doesn't know, actually this is part of like a sexual assault prevention, sexual violence prevention training at Queens, where like, it's basically a form of like self-defense that's for women, where it's really great if you're like 5'3" and like tiny like me to still, you know, have the power to be able to get out of like, or, you know, handle like awful situations. So, you know, I think that those things are important, and it is important to like give women the sort of like power to deal with difficult situations and like understand, you know, like their rights and things when it comes to consent, and the importance of that. But even at Queens, like when we had that training, I asked, you know, like how much, you know, to what extent are men required to do this training, or to what extent are like men sort of offered, men on campus offered any sort of conversation, frank conversation about consent or like violence and sexual violence and all these things. And the university hadn't actually like allocated any money to that, frankly. So it's just, I think that that's one thing that maybe we could talk about, you know, like that's also like another part of this problem. Susan mentioned that she wanted to weigh in. So maybe if you wanted to speak to that, Susan.
Yeah, so I was part of organizing some Wendo training when my daughter and her peers were in grade 7. And it was great. She's even more petite than Hina, and she learned how to break someone's collarbone. But also as part of that, there was a lot of anti-oppression training and also, you know, around issues of consent, because a lot of young women just, you know, even don't have that analysis. And I agree about doing it on the other side. It's interesting, my 20-year-old son is part of a tree planting crew, and as part of the health and safety, they came into the camp and they talked about issues of consent with everyone who was in the camp. So that was, you know, part of training everyone in advance. There's also some interesting work, men's work happening with a group called Legacy here in Guelph. And I think a lot of that, it's not necessarily an overt purpose, but I think it really is about addressing this kind of toxic masculinity and for men challenging each other as peers, how they are behaving in their relationships. And so I do see that as a really a great initiative in terms of men taking responsibility for supporting each other to grow and calling each other accountable for toxic conduct.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's my contribution.
Okay. Kate also wanted to say something as well.
Something that like I think needs to like take place in these conversations a lot of the time. It like needs to start from like a young age. Like it needs to start from like elementary school and onwards, because it's not like, I just graduated high school in 2019, and like that's pretty recent, and like it was not talked about once. We didn't have conversations around like consent or talking about like men and the role they play in like this sort of like cycle, you know, like we never had those conversations, and like issues definitely came up. We had problems with men in my grade that definitely did exceed boundaries, and men that flat out sexually assaulted girls that I went to school with, and it was very much like we pushed it under the rug, like from like a school standpoint, it was very much shoved under the rug, not talked about, and it wasn't addressed then to the broader, you know, population. Like, we never had conversations about, like, you know, like, these are boundaries you can set as a woman, and like, it's okay to, like, you know, not to say no. And we never had those conversations, and we never also talked about, like, men, like, you have a very important role to play in, like, how, you know, how women are treated in society. Like, we never, like, those conversations never came up. And like, maybe it was because I went to a Catholic school, I don't know, but like, from talking from others as well, like, I think like, that's something that we're failing at, like, a, like, at that level, in like an education level. Like, that's a really good opportunity to do better as a society and to learn how to do better and like have those tough conversations with men and other perpetrators, but like, we're not having those conversations from an early age. And like, maybe, like, I guess Susan was saying, like, her son was talked to when he was 20 for the tree planting thing. Maybe for like a lot of men, that was like the first time they've ever had that conversation or ever had someone bring that up to them, right? And like, that's too late. Like, that's too
late. Not my son.
Well, yes. That's why I said other men, because I definitely knew, like, you would have that conversation. But yeah, it's just like, we're just failing folks at like a education level as well, I think, when it comes to this.
That's all the time we have for this week. Special thanks to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Alt, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gevert, Hina Mistry, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. If you'd like to join us or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you next week on the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour.